Hello and welcome to Books of the Year, the podcast from your very good friends at the podcast, which is usually called Books of the Year. We have some big news, Matt.
Oh, what's our big news?
Very, very exciting
okay,
news.
Okay, I like it. Go ahead.
We are on YouTube.
Oh, that is... I'm sounding really excited, even though I can't talk. That's how excited I am.
A brand new channel available at Books of the Year, so please follow and subscribe over on YouTube so you never miss an episode, and you can watch the pod in glorious Technicolor, which means we're going to have to start thinking about wardrobe.
Yes, I can't really wear what I'm wearing today where I've been splashed all the way from home to this studio.
But unfortunately, we are on YouTube.
Oh, we are on YouTube yes. right now. Brilliant. I'm so glad I was splashed all the way from here to home.
Anyway, so it's at Books of the Year. Follow, subscribe, and you will go to heaven. I think that's the deal.
Is that the deal?
An email from Harry in Taunton. Simon and Matt, long-time listener, second-time emailer. My wife, Sandra, the good lady indoors, went to see Hamnet at the cinema recently. Local film club event. She came back raving about it, even though she said she bawled her eyes out for most of the film. "And you still haven't read it," she exclaimed to me. For context, about 6 months ago, she gave me her copy of the Maggie O'Farrell novel, Hamnet, and it has remained unopened on my bedside table. After her ringing endorsement of the film, and the rest of the nation, it seems, and the Oscars, I finally picked up the book. Simon and Matt, it's brilliant. Finished it in 4 days. What a great author Maggie is. I'm sure you know, having had her on your pod in the past. I promise to always listen to my wife in future. From Harry. Well, listen to us as well.
Yeah.
So never mind your wife. I mean, obviously your wife is most...
Yeah. You were a huge fan of the movie, weren't you? You loved it.
I did. I did like it. And I liked the book as well. And so, yes. Well, you're a very wise person, Harry. Listen to your wife first. Listen to Matt and me second.
Correct. An email from Lucy Gaines. Hello, chums. Love the show, Steve. Love the shoe, Steve, it says here, but never mind. Luce goes on that you often ask your guests how they organise their bookshelves at home, and it got me thinking about my own cluttered mess of literature. I don't organise by genre or alphabetically or by colour, goodness knows how. I organise then by when I read them. So each time I finish a book, one I want to keep, I should say, I then add it to the end of the line on the shelves. Have you heard of this before? Am I mad? Keep up the moderate work, Luce. Well, that's how I used to order mine by when you read them. I just, stick it at the end of the line. However, I should admit that on two of my shelves, I had an idle moment and I decided I'm going to try ordering these by colour. And I did. And the effect is not unpleasant. So I go, basically, it really works with books. So I should emphasize that loads of bookshelves. This was two bookshelves.
Yes.
If you get all the yellow ones together and all the red ones together and you put those next to each other, the effect is pretty good. The rest of them is just a hodgepodge. Loads and loads of... Basically, what you find is that most books have either got a black cover or a black spine or a white spine. Most of them.
Do you have too much time on your hands?
I did have a little bit of time that day. Yes, but it's a striking scene when you walk into that room. You go, wow, look at those books. Doesn't that look amazing?
Nicely arranged.
Yes.
I wonder if we can use our YouTube channel to show videos of people's
That is an excellent idea. Yes.
Can we do that? I don't know. Can we do that? So it's like a bookshelfie kind of thing.
Yes.
So,
Oh, bookshelfie. I like that. Yeah.
Maybe, let's just see. You might not want to do it. But if you do, send us... I don't know, 5-10 second video of your bookshelves, how they're arranged, whether they be shambolic or whether they be incredible, like you're suggesting.
Incredible,
doing it
color. No, I think, and also a little explanation of how you've done it, because loads of other writers we've had on have said, no, I don't do it cut by color, but I do it by genre, or I do it by country. We've had a few times.
That was John Boyne, so, I think.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay. You can email us at any time, booksthe@yahoo.com. I would have thought that, and also if you're going to email us, you can send us the video on that email. Would that work?
I'm sure that would. I think you're allowed videos on email.
Yes, just a short one, a brief one.
Would brief that, one?
Do you think? I'm just looking for technical support.
Maybe on socials, maybe send it on socials. Can they do that? I don't know.
A brief one on email is probably okay. Anyway, also Instagram, also Threads, also Blue Sky at Books of the Year. Time now to speak to Pulitzer Prize winning author Elizabeth Strout. Elizabeth Elizabeth Strout, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you so
much. Matt and I were both convinced that you were going to be back home and you'd be appearing at like 5 a.m. for us, but this is far more social.
It's much more lovely to be here in person.
I apologize about the weather. It's a bit shocking outside.
No, don't worry about it. It happens.
Do you enjoy book promotion and tours and meeting readers?
I do enjoy meeting readers. Yeah, I do. I get tired with the promotion, but it's very important for me to meet my readers.
I can, for reasons that I think will become clear, because I feel as though we have a very personal relationship with your characters. It's a very intimate book. Matt, would you please describe the cover that we're looking at for The Things We Never Say?
Yeah, it's a striking cover, this one. And you will have seen it on, well, I think, Simon, you were saying you were walking past a bookstore and all you could see in the window was covers of this book.
It was this book, that's
yeah. And so the main picture is, it's a really simple one, but it is striking. It's a single chair with a blue jacket hanging off the back of the chair. And it's in the corner of a room, and just on the right side of the picture is a window, and through that window is streaming some summer sun, and you can see the sea just through the window as well. And then Elizabeth Strout in black letters at the top, The Things We Never Say, right down the middle of that cover. And Anne Patchett at the bottom says, one of my very favourite writers. Hilary Mantel says, a superbly gifted storyteller. At the top, from the Pulitzer Prize winning Booker shortlisted author. Oh, and Zadie Smith says, a terrific writer as well. Goodness me.
I mean, that's
all of them, isn't it?
So thanks for coming in, Elizabeth. Yes. That's all anyone needs. It's a bit like a Hopper painting, I think.
I think so too.
That's what the cover.
I love Hopper, and I was thrilled with that. Yeah.
It does look fantastic. Is it a photograph or a painting?
I think it's a painting.
Well, it's beautiful. I hope you've got the original framed.
No, but it would be lovely if I did.
Introduce us to the book then, and Artie Dam, who's our main character that we follow through this story.
Right. It's a little hard. Okay, sorry.
That's fine.
Okay, so basically Artie Dam is a 57-year-old history school teacher, high school teacher in Massachusetts off the coast. His life appears to be fine. He's known as jovial, jolly, but his interior life is not so jovial and jolly, and he's struggling, and then he stops struggling, and then he starts to struggle again, I guess.
I
can tell you without
because there's lots obviously that we can't say. And I would say this is quite a short book. It's like 200 pages, mm-hmm. but every page matters, every paragraph mm-hmm. matters, every line matters. Where did Artie come from in your head?
The only thing I can remember is that a few years ago, a friend of mine in upstate New York sent me some obituaries from the 60s. Never mind. He just does that once in a while.
That's a weird thing to
send
to
a friend.
Yeah,
I know. We have a weird friendship, but never mind that. The point is, I was looking at these obituaries and there was this fellow whose last name was Dam, D-A-M-M. And I remember thinking that was an interesting name, although I dropped one of the M's, obviously. But his face was so ordinary and so pleasant, just so extremely ordinary.
What does that mean?
It just meant that he didn't look distressed. He didn't look puzzled. He just looked like, hello, you know? And he had those big wire-framed glasses that they had back then. And his face stayed with me. And it's not particularly Artie Dam's face, but the character that was behind that face stayed with me.
Okay. And Artie is a history teacher.
Yes.
This is all very important and very significant. Just tell us about where he teaches and the kind of history that he teaches.
Right. He teaches on the coast of Massachusetts, and he teaches the Civil War, and he's been teaching this for years. And he teaches the Civil War by assigning his students either a nurse or a soldier from the Civil War, and they are to look up the letters and read the letters and sort of take on the identity of the soldier or the nurse. And he's been doing that for many, many years.
Okay. And so let's dig in a little bit more to him as a teacher, because I loved him as a character, and I think part of the reason I did is that I think anyone reading this book will, when they read Artie, will have in their head as well a teacher who really connected with them when they were at school, because he manages. There are two or three pupils in his class that he has a direct impact on. And in fact, later on in the book, you say how these characters then think back of their time with this particular teacher. But it did feel, it felt like that sort of, I know it's a cliche to say, but that sort of love poem towards teachers and teaching.
Precisely.
And I just want you to dig into that a little bit more for us. This idea of what you were trying to say about teachers and what the messages, the lessons they're trying to impart to these people.
Right. And Artie, you know, he was given Teacher of the Year award, which he accepted and his wife was very thrilled about, but he didn't really care because he really just loves his students. That's what he cares. He's sort of born to be a teacher and he is a teacher in the most genuine way. And I think that kind of teacher, I think they're almost doing an act of faith because they're throwing themselves forward, you know, to be maybe picked up, maybe not for 20 or 25 years will somebody remember something and go, oh, that man made such a difference to me, or that woman, or whoever it is. And Artie does, specifically in this book, change two lives. I mean, we've assumed that he's changed many more before this, but that's the kind of person he is, that he can do that. And he remembers his own junior high school, back then it was called junior high, teacher, Mr. Stepanak, who had done that for him as well.
And it was something you just said there. It's intriguing that when we think of those things, it's often years later that we realize. In other words, at the time, we don't quite notice it. Obviously, you know, we're in our teens or whatever, and we don't take these things in. But it's years later. I know it's me for my French teacher.
Yeah.
Years later, I realized, oh my goodness.
I know. Yeah. That's exactly it. And that's why I think it's, like I said, an act of faith, because you just don't know. You will not know in your lifetime, probably, ever, what you've done. But you've done it.
Can I ask you about the time frame, Elizabeth? Because right at the beginning of the book, and it is one of those books where so many lines, so many paragraphs are worth dwelling on before you race on to the next bit. But this is not a book about COVID, but you do talk about the impact of COVID on the students.
Right.
And you say that it changed the students and that they were anxious and that Artie found it difficult to make them talk. It just seems to me that there's a whole book's worth of information there.
Right.
What made you put that in?
Well, I have, there's a group of young people that I know back in Maine and throughout a little bit in New England. And I have noticed, and their COVID experience came just at such a terrible time. I mean, it was terrible for everybody, but just as they were either going to college or maybe had just started college or something like that, or even still in high school. And I realized that it was just very, very difficult for them. And they've had to make severe adjustments. And so when I was writing this book, and I talked to a couple of contemporary high school teachers to make sure that I was right about that. And they said, absolutely, that it had changed since COVID. And people were just, there's an anxiety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've mentioned on this podcast before, I do think that over a generation or two, the COVID will impact on storytelling.
Yes.
And that the First World War and the Second World War, we're still finding new stories to tell, which affected a certain number of people.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in the world pretty much has a COVID story.
Right.
And so I just think it'll take a while, but
I think you're right.
So,
but that's a little mention of it there, because kids are.
Yeah. So that's the time frame. So it's post-COVID, but it's the present. We're kind of gearing up to the present day.
Yes. Like very specifically 2024, you know. It's about 6 or 9 months, I think.
Okay, so it's before the second Trump election, and then the Trump election, and then a few months afterwards.
Right, exactly.
Speaking of which, there's plenty I want to ask you about regarding that, particularly towards the end of the book. The title of the book is The Things We Never Say, and so I do want to talk about that dynamic where we don't talk about certain things. And obviously, you know, we've mentioned Trump there, but politics in the US feels like it has become one of those subjects. I was struck by something that Artie says, and I think it's to his wife at some point in the book. He says, why don't people ever say anything real?
Right.
And now he knew why, because to say anything real was to say things that nobody wanted to know, or if they wanted to know, they would not care in the right way or even understand. And it feels like, you know, there's that old thing of, you know, we don't talk about politics or religion. And it always felt like that was more like a polite thing.
Right.
Whereas now it feels like I'm not absolutely sure that that you're not going to A, disagree with me, and B, if we disagree, that's it.
Precisely.
We are so polarized now. Yeah. That is it. We will draw a line and you and I cannot talk again.
That's right. That's exactly it. And it's just so sad. It's just terrible, you know, to see it, especially at my age, to have watched the evolution of that and come to that point. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a survey done of Americans recently that asked them, what is the thing that they are most concerned about in their country? And you hear that and you think, right, number one is maybe going to be immigration or is going to be cost of living or anything else. By a country mile, the thing that most Americans are concerned about is that how split the country has become, that they can't just talk to their, if they're a Democrat, can't talk to their Republican friends anymore because it descends into a row every time.
It's terrible. It's true. It's absolutely true. We are very, very, very divided.
So the things we never say, that might be a good thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think this title wasn't meant to say we should say them. I mean, it's just a statement of fact, the things we never say. But yes, I mean, people have to protect themselves. And in America right now, that's how we're doing it. We're just not saying anything about politics, particularly.
What RT is talking about a lot is free will.
Mm. Yeah.
Why is he so fascinated, borderline obsessed with talking to all his friends and neighbors about free will?
Well, because of, you know, when the book opens and he's feeling distressed and he doesn't yet know why he's feeling distressed, he will find out later and the reader will find out later because of his wife has intermittently backed off a little bit and his son has backed off a great deal. So we'll find out why later. But at that beginning of the book, when he's feeling distressed, it's a thought that goes through his mind because he thinks, well, how did I end up like this? You know, what is the story with this? Is there any free will or is this all preordained? And he's not really had thoughts like that before because his life has just sort of bubbled along.
Is there perhaps an element where he is losing control and there's a sort of anger that he's losing control? I think that at some point in the book, he thinks he might be having a stroke, but it's almost that he feels, I don't understand what, normally I'm in control, normally, and up until this point I have been, but now it feels like I'm not in control.
He's doing things that he doesn't understand why he's doing them and, you know, getting angry at one student in a way that he's never been angry at a student before, you know, so that kind of thing makes him wonder about himself. And then he decides it's his unconscious.
So what would you ascribe that sort of lack of self or inability to control oneself? What would you put that down?
I think that he's just feeling, he's gone through a real upheaval, as we find out, you know, about halfway through the book. It's like, wow, that's a lot, Artie, to have to deal with. And he does deal with it. And he deals with it in a beautiful way, I think. And but it's a lot. It's a little life-changing. Not a little life-changing. It's definitely life-changing. And so he has to absorb that. And I think as, you know, he's not necessarily been an introspective man. That's not his forte. His forte is to give himself to his students. Yeah. And so I think that he's bewildered, I guess is the word, bewildered.
Yeah.
And in his bewilderment and, you know, not understanding himself particularly, he does do things that bewilder him even more.
Very early on, page 8, because I checked, we learn of a tragedy in the family to do with his son and son's girlfriend at the time. And you have a phrase, Elizabeth, and one of the joys of this book is stumbling across phrases that will just stick with you, is you say, it took years for them to reconfigure themselves. And I thought that was such a great phrase because that's what people have to do.
Right, precisely.
And almost everyone listening will have had something that's happened to them.
Yeah.
Be a breakup or bereavement or and they have to reconfigure the way they live their lives.
Right. Thank you. because you're right. We have to do it frequently, actually, in little ways and then in much larger ways, which Artie's family had to do after that, the terrible accident. But they had to reconfigure.
I think maybe that's what I'm getting at for the start of the book. If he's not going through breakdown, that process of reconfiguration is still going on.
Yes.
Maybe it doesn't
probably start. Will go on for the rest of their lives.
Let's talk about Trump, because even though Trump isn't, I don't know whether he's even mentioned at all in the book. I don't think he is.
Never in the
book. But it's quite clear where we are. You mentioned world events, and it's quite clear where as Simon was saying before, where we are in the timeline. And although this, so there's a four-word phrase that I have heard so many times. This doesn't appear in your book, but it drives me wild. He'll be gone soon. In other words, this will pass. He'll be gone soon and everything will return to normal. And even though that four-word phrase doesn't appear in your book, I think Artie sees through it. I think he sees that as, no, I'm afraid things have now changed.
Right.
Can you just talk a little bit about
that? Well, Artie's a history teacher, so he's studied history. So he knows probably a little bit more than the average person who's, you know, going off to the stock exchange or whatever they're going to do for the day, or to their, you know, job as a coffee person. I mean, whatever their jobs are, Artie has a little bit more of an insider's view into the history. And I think that he is aware of the deep dangers that are about to take place. And in fact, have taken place. You know, I mean, the Department of Justice has been gutted. The IRS is sort of hobbling around. The CIA, the FBI is like, who knows? I mean, the Pentagon, all these things, all these parts of the government have just been changed so dramatically that I think it would be quite a while, if ever, before we could get it together.
But as I say, those people who say he'll be gone soon, are basically, they're implying, listen, I know all these things have happened and maybe I don't support all of them, but he'll be gone soon and everything will return to normal. And my instinct is that Artie does not believe that's going to happen.
No.
These things have taken decades to put in place and that it will not be easy to put them back in place.
That's exactly how Artie feels. Yes.
It's concerning. As people who love America, that's concerning.
It sure is.
Artie has, you mentioned his wife, he has a son. He's loved at school. He has a good relationship with his fellow teachers and most of his pupils, and yet he's lonely.
Right.
Why is he lonely?
Well, at the beginning, he's lonely because, like I said, his wife has stepped back from him intermittently, and then only later do we find out why. And because his son has really distanced himself even more than with the original accident. And that's, so it makes him lonely. This is his family, and he doesn't even quite know that's happening. I mean, he certainly understands that Rob has distanced himself more. He is aware of that, but he's not even really fully aware that Evie is in and out in a certain way because they've been married a long time. Mm-hmm. And so he just feels it, but he doesn't know it, if you see what I mean.
There are occasionally when you are particularly engrossed in a book and a book is working for you, I find that you get to a particular passage and there's a little tug that happens internally. You go, I get that. That's true. And Rob, the son, Artie's son, talks about his father as being my explorer.
Right.
That you're going ahead of me.
Right.
You are doing things before I am.
Right.
I need you around because of that,
right.
And I won't know what to do. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah,
what to do, how to behave without you.
Yeah,
I love that. I don't think I have two sons, but I wonder where that came from. That idea of a parental figure being an explorer for their child.
It's just something, you know, that I have observed over the years. Not even in my own personal situation, although it has to be true. But I've just observed that. Certain patterns follow through generations. And, you know, if somebody does take a sidestep or something, that will affect the next few generations, which will affect the next, you know. I mean, it was just an instinct I had that this is what we might not understand as parents, that we are to our children. We are, no matter how old they are, we are, often anyway, not always, but we are their guide. Even if they are still, even if they're angry at us or whatever, you know, but we are fundamentally, in a way, their guide.
Yeah, it's interesting because the idea of an explorer is sort of, is very neutral. It's not saying, you're great or no, you're not
precisely.
Great. It's just precisely. That kind of, I need you there because right. you are going ahead of me.
That's exactly it. Right. Right.
That, and that notion of an I'd never thought of that before, but it resonated with me yeah. as well. This idea of being an explorer. It's not quite, I'm giving you license to do right. what I've done, but I'm going there to show you that it can be done.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the thing. And yeah. And so a parent should sort of keep that in mind a little bit.
Another thing,
as far as we can keep anything in mind.
Absolutely. an emotion that the first word I wrote down at the back of the book, I always make notes at the back of the book when I'm reading. And the first one I wrote down was after there is a fight at a football game.
Yeah.
And that word was anger. And it felt like there was that anger sort of builds yep. through the book.
Right.
Can you just talk to us a bit about anger?
Yes. Let me just back up a little bit and mention when I was talking about how he teaches his class and then the principal calls him in and says, by the way, Artie, the school board wants you to start taking on Confederate students as well as Massachusetts. And that's the first signal that things are not going that well in this country. And then that fight at the soccer game is very much there for a reason. And in fact, it was interesting because once I had written that scene, my husband, who knows different teachers and different people, he said, you know, this is actually happening more, which was fascinating. Really? So, yeah, so there are more fights breaking out. And that's why Hoover, the principal, says to Artie, I think he says, you know, this is happening around. So anyway, people are angry. That's the point. There are people that are angry. They're not able to talk about it. And so they're going to get in arguments. And this was a political fight, it turns out. You know, they figured out.
So yeah, I hadn't thought that you've tied that together. That
yeah.
the title of the book, The Things We're Not Talking About,
yeah.
because we're not talking about right. them, that's leading to anger.
Yes, a lot of it is. Right. Right. Okay. And there the kids pick up on it, the parent, you know, people are fighting.
Can you tell us a bit about the geography, Elizabeth?
Yeah.
Maine, Massachusetts. Been close. I haven't actually been there. What does the reader, obviously your American audience will know a little bit more and will have visited, but the geography of this place is important
right.
To the story. Also, the kind of people
right.
That we're dealing with. I've heard you say before that Maine people don't talk very much,
right.
which I'm intrigued by. But just tell us more about where we are with this
right.
story.
Well, Maine and Massachusetts are, I mean, they're close together, but they're quite different. I mean, everybody always thinks of New England as one place, and it is, but it's very different. Every state has its own flavor. And Massachusetts is quite different from Maine, and there's more people, there's a higher population, there's, you know, per mile or whatever, and there's more money. There's larger class differences, even though in Maine there's big class differences as well. But and Massachusetts people do actually talk more than Maine people, but not about necessarily things that are important at this point.
You mentioned class differences. Could you just also, class is important because Artie lives in this house. He didn't really that he belongs
That's
there.
Right. Artie was from a working class background. His father was a superintendent of three apartment buildings in Revere, which is a very working class part of Massachusetts, or it was when Artie was growing up. And he married into like a Brahmin family. I mean, you know, a very wealthy woman he marries. And when he's young, it's sort of like fine. I mean, he's in love with her. It doesn't really matter. But then as he's getting older, he thinks about his parents and he's never felt ashamed of them. And he still doesn't. But he understands more and more as he gets older, the vast difference between the world he came from and the world he entered with his marriage.
But how fascinating that people, just looking at the title of your book, The Things We Never Say. If you come from Maine, maybe that's more than everyone else, you know, because maybe if you don't talk very much, there's even more that you don't say.
That's right. It's an awful lot, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But why do they want to say more? Is it just that they are kind of stiff upper lip, or are they just not very emotional, or what is
I think they're probably emotional. I don't know. I mean, I come from Maine, but I'm obviously quite chatty, and I always joke that there must have been a genetic mutation because my family was not so chatty. And But it's not, I don't think they're lacking emotions at all. I think it's just a cultural thing. And then I was just recently in Ireland, a couple of people in the audience said that they were from Canada and it was a similar thing up there as well. So it might just be the colder we get, the more yeah, northern
the less
we
talk.
Get. Yeah. Yeah, the less talk. I don't know. I really don't know, but it's the culture of Maine.
So we've talked about quite a lot of weighty matters in the book and for good reason, but there is something that I do want to talk to you about, yeah. which I really liked. And also I thought, I can't believe this is not more widely known. It's a little life lesson that Artie passes on to another character about how to break up with someone.
Oh yeah.
And I thought, do you know what? That's something you're not given that life lesson. It's never something that you taught your child how to break up with someone. But it's so important about how you do it, right. Because that's going to have such an impact. Tell us a little about that, because it's a right. sort of lighter side.
Right, and his son Rob wants to break up with this younger woman that he's met, and his father pulls the car over, because he's talking to him on the phone, he pulls the car over, and he says, okay, I'll tell you how. And he said, you take her to a place, don't invite her over, don't go to her place, take her to a neutral place, either a diner or someplace like that, and just tell her straightforwardly it's not working out the way you thought. She'll be very upset, but then that will be over, and that's what you have to do. And he calls back and he goes, it worked. Yeah. And then Artie begins to realize, because his father had told him that about his older girlfriend Gretchen way before he met his wife, and then Artie begins to wonder, how did Dad know that? How did he know that?
So, well, yeah. is this a lesson you've learned, or is this you just decided? No.
I just listen to people all the time. I listen to everybody talking about their lives and stuff like that. So I've picked that up at some point.
Oh, right. Oh, so yeah. You've been next to someone who's been breaking
up
with someone.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yes.
And it worked really well when you were hearing them doing it. Was this in a cafe or something?
Yeah. Yeah. I listen all the time and you'll hear stuff.
You'd make.
I mean, in New York, where they talk. Yeah. I mean, not in Maine.
Not in Canada.
No.
Yeah. No use. I've been sitting here all day. No one said a word.
Yeah.
when you start out telling this story, Elizabeth, how much do you know what you're going to write, and how much is a process of discovery as you go?
Right. It's all a process of discovery. I know almost nothing when I start out. And that's what, the only thing is that in that first paragraph, I remember thinking, I want the word jovial in there, because people are going to think of this man as jovial. I thought him as jovial. And then as I wrote along and I realized he's actually quite distressed, I didn't know why he was distressed. And then as I went back and I thought, what am I going to do now? I've started a book with this. How in the world is this going to work out? And then as I looked back, I realized, oh, I had actually set myself some sort of breadcrumbs, you know, hints that I hadn't even been conscious of. Like his wife and his son. And then I realized, oh, so I found out about 5 minutes before Artie found out this great big family secret.
That's just astonishing, because obviously different writers write in different ways. And there are people who plot meticulously and there are people who just start like you do.
Yeah.
Ian Rankin says the same thing. Lee Child says, you know, says the same thing. But I think that process of discovery must be quite thrilling.
It is. It really is. I was so happy when I figured out what was going on. I was like, yeah, okay, now I get it. So right, like, Artie, we can do this.
do you kind of disappear into this world and these lives?
Yes, I do. I when I'm working, I just try so hard to be that character. I'm just as far inside him as I can possibly get. It's concentration.
So you are in Artie's head?
Yes. Yeah.
Was that fun?
Yes. Yes.
Were there any characters that you wrote about, Elizabeth, that you would like to return to?
I really just don't know. I mean, I think Francesca's a little bit intriguing, his wife.
A little bit intriguing. That's maybe you weren't then.
I don't know. We'll see. No idea.
So maybe you'll just start. How do you know that you're ready to go then? If the book is a process of discovery, how do you know? Have you got lots of kind of opening paragraphs which never?
Yeah,
went,
I have.
Never
went I to have it? So many different things sort of moving around the desk all the time, and maybe one will come back to me, or maybe one I'll realize, oh, you've got to actually go and throw it out. But I have many different openings and many different people. And then at some point, one of them will grab hold of me.
It's like a percolation process.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is, exactly.
I mentioned this to Matt a few weeks ago, that this book reminded me of a phrase which apparently is a very well-known quote, and I hadn't come across it. But it was the actor Gabriel Byrne was talking about a film that he was in. And he mentioned this quote from Gabriel Garcia Marquez, that we all have three lives. We have a public life, a private life, and a secret life. And this book, more than any other that I can remember reading, is inhabiting that last one.
That's a great quote.
We see the public and the private life, and that's a part of every book. And we get the jovial, and we get the teacher, and all that, and the mm-hmm. relationship with his son and with his mm-hmm. wife. But that inhabiting that secret life, yeah. that's something else.
Oh, well, leave it to Marquez. That's fabulous. It's a great quote.
Does it feel that's where most of the book takes place for you?
Yes. And that is actually, I speak of it as the interior life, because I have always been interested as a writer in going into the interior life of a person and watching how it bumps up against the exterior world. But a secret life is so much more interesting. The phrase is so much.
So there was just one bit. Now, even though it's page 57, this mm-hmm. isn't revealing of anything, but maybe it is part of what you were just talking about. You say, so blind we humans, it's bizarre reading your book out to yeah. you.
No, but anyway, that's fine.
So blind we humans are, so blind to each other and to ourselves, moving through life as though through shadows, putting out a hand in the dark and thinking we have touched someone. And maybe we have, as Artie did with Rhonda Lazar, one of the other characters. But mostly, we travel through life unsighted, grasping only the smallest details of one another's selves, including our own, thinking all the while that we can see. That's a whole book, and that's like six lines.
Right. And that was a little risky for me to do, because that's the narrator directly addressing the reader. And I don't think I've ever done that before. Directing the reader, directly telling the reader something that the narrator thinks, as opposed to just saying, here's the tree and here's the house. And, so that was a little risky, but I thought I would do it.
So who is the narrator?
Probably me.
Yeah, I guess that's right. How long did this take, this book, from start to finish, Elizabeth?
It didn't. Probably a year and a half. It didn't take very long. Maybe 2 years. I'm not good with time, because it's all in my mind. It's all run on and, smushed up. Sorry. So I don't really know, but I do remember thinking it felt like it came out almost in one piece, and then I added to it and put it, I would go over it a number of times, but it felt like it swished out. Mm.
And is that process always the same? Are you speeding up, slowing down, just the same?
It's never the same. The book before Tell Me Everything, I don't think that was a slow book, but it felt like it was a very different process from writing this book.
Well, so I'm intrigued, because this is the first of your books that I've read, and my heart leapt when it came through my letterbox. And I'll be absolutely honest, my heart leapt because of how thin it is.
Yeah,
and it's so right. You straight away you're like, oh, right. Great! Right. I'm a huge fan of the theory. No movie should be more than 2 hours long. Right. Tell your story, and you managed to tell this. As Simon's just said, that paragraph, there's a book in that one paragraph. So you managed to tell this story in such a condensed manner. And is that a discipline that you've worked at, because I don't know your other books, so are your other books more sprawling, more epic than this one?
I think that my books have increasingly become similar to this style, although this has its own particular style. Like, I do things like with parentheses and stuff in this book that I haven't done since my very first book, which was longer. But I think that over time, my sentences have become cleaner and more direct and to the point. And then also, it depends on the story I'm telling. And this story had to be told this way, you see. Yeah. But that style is one that is my style.
But is there a discipline there where you're going, no, I'm getting rid of it. I love that paragraph, and it's a great paragraph, but it's going because it's not performing how it needs to for this book. It's not doing what I need it to do for this book.
I think that what you just described, the paragraph is going, I think that was probably about 8 books ago. that I was able to say, this is going, and now I just don't write that paragraph. Okay. So I've taught myself over the years, because I've been writing for so long that I've taught myself over the years, okay, no, that's not relevant. Just go straight to it.
You're like Mozart, basically.
Thank you very much.
It comes out fully formed and perfect.
There you go.
Well, as you can tell, we both love the book.
Thank
Elizabeth.
You so much.
Elizabeth Strout's book is The Things We Never Say. There'll be more with Elizabeth in our separate extra podcast, the Q&A, which will be with you in a few days. But for the moment, Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both very, very much.